DAZN zeigt jetzt die Königsklasse. Streame Galatasaray gegen Schalke morgen um 21 Uhr live. Teste DAZN jetzt einen Monat lang kostenlos. Danach zahlst du, wenn du willst, nur 9,99 € im Monat und kannst monatlich kündigen. Galatasaray gegen Schalke und weitere Top-Matches der UEFA Champions und Europa League live. Starte jetzt deinen Gratis-Monat auf DAZN.com.
Starting Grid, die Formel 1 Show mit Kevin Scheuren und Ole Waschkau auf meinsportradio.de wird dir präsentiert von motorsporttotal.com und formel1.de. Keep
racing. Einen schönen guten Tag und herzlich willkommen zu Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Magazin auf meinsportradio.de. Mein Name ist Kevin Scheuren. Schön, dass ihr bei dieser kleinen Sonderausgabe eingeschaltet habt. Heute habe ich ein ganz tolles, ausführliches Interview mit Mark Gallagher für euch vorbereitet. Mark Gallagher, er war in Mönchengladbach dabei, als David Coulthard da war, mit dem ich ja auch sprechen konnte. Das könnt ihr euch im Archiv auf meinsportradio.de anhören oder bei iTunes, wo auch immer ihr diesen tollen Podcast abonniert. Und er hat sehr viel Erfahrung in der Formel 1, nicht nur auf Seiten der Medien, denn er ist Experte für BBC, für Channel 4, für Sky. Er war auch sehr lange Zeit im Hintergrund in der Formel 1 tätig, nämlich als Marketingdirektor, als Sponsoringdirektor für verschiedene Teams, für Jordan, für Red Bull, für Jaguar. Er war der Chef der Motorenabteilung von Cosworth, also für die Marketing, also für das Zwischenmenschliche zwischen den Firmen, zwischen den Teams, die gearbeitet haben. Ja, es ist Wahnsinn, was dieser Mann alles schon erlebt hat in der Formel 1. Er ist gerade mal 56, kann aber jede Menge Geschichten erzählen. Und einige dieser Geschichten, die erzählt er heute. Wir sprechen natürlich auch kurz über den US-Grand Prix gestern. Lewis Hamilton, der noch nicht fünffacher Weltmeister ist, sondern noch warten muss bis nächste Woche in Mexiko. Kimi Räikkönen konnte tatsächlich ein Rennen gewinnen. Und da muss ich natürlich noch einen Besen fressen, dass Kimi Räikkönen tatsächlich ein Rennen gewonnen hat. Irgendwer sagte, dass ich wohl gesagt habe, dass wir eine Wette abgeschlossen haben, dass Kimi Räikkönen doch noch ein Rennen gewinnt. Ich war ja fest davon überzeugt, dass Kimi Räikkönen kein Rennen mehr gewinnt. Das hat er geschafft. Und deswegen sind wir dabei, im Archiv mal ein bisschen durchzuhören, was das denn für ein Wetteinsatz war. Ich hoffe, es war nichts allzu Schlimmes. Ich habe da ein bisschen Angst vor. Ging nämlich tatsächlich nicht davon aus, dass das nochmal passiert. Gut, so sei es. Max Verstappen auf 2, Sebastian Vettel auf 4 hat jetzt noch ganz, 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 ganz kleine Chancen, Formel 1 Weltmeister zu werden. Wir sprechen sehr ausführlich über das Rennen am morgigen Dienstag. Also die nächste Ausgabe kommt dann schon morgen. Hab diese Woche bis zum Mexiko Grand Prix also jede Menge zu hören hier von uns. Und ich kann euch einfach nur empfehlen, gleich das Interview mit Mark Gallagher genauso aufzusaugen, wie ich es aufgesaugt habe beim Führen des Interviews. Wir haben über super viele Sachen gesprochen. Wir haben darüber gesprochen, ob man ein guter Racer gewesen sein muss, um ein guter Teamchef zu sein. Wir sprechen, oder haben sehr viel über Jordan gesprochen, über das Projekt von Eddie Jordan, das so viel Erfolg gehabt hat, sogar Möglichkeiten hatte, eventuell um die Weltmeisterschaft mitzufahren mit Heinz-Harald Frentzen 1999. Dann haben wir über Sponsoren gesprochen und da ist ein Thema natürlich die Tabakwerbung, die verboten worden ist und deswegen auch sehr viel Geld aus der Formel 1 verschwunden ist über die Jahre. Hat sich die Formel 1 davon erholen können, dass keine Tabaksponsoren mehr da sind? Darüber sprechen wir. Wir sprechen über Ideen, wie man die Formel 1 verbessern kann, wie man die Fannähe steigern kann. Wir sprechen über F1 TV. Ihr habt Fragen gestellt in unserer Starting Grid F1 Fans Facebook-Gruppe. Nochmal vielen Dank dafür. Viele davon konnte ich einbringen. Es war nur der Anfang und es sind trotzdem fast 1,5 Stunden, die wir gesprochen haben. Also ihr habt jede Menge Stoff für euch heute. Es ist auf Englisch. Ich hoffe, das ist okay für euch. Ja, was bleibt mir zu sagen? Bleibt dran, kurze Pause und dann geht's los. Hier das Interview mit Mark Gallagher bei Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Magazin auf meinsportradio.de.
Hallo, hier ist Benny Hövelis und ich höre meinsportradio.de.
Hören, was andere denken auf meinsportradio.de. Hören, was andere denken, meinsportradio.de. Like it auf Facebook/meinsportradio.
Right now I'm happy to be joined by Mark Gallagher. Who of you listeners do even know Mark Gallagher? I bet many of you think, who is this man? But he has a stellar career in Formula One, not as a race driver, but in the backbone of the team, in the management positions. He worked for the Jordan F1 team, he worked for Jaguar Racing, for Red Bull Racing, he worked, of course, for Cosworth's F1 engine business. He is a very successful man. He has very pointed ideas in Formula One and in management, and I'm very happy to be joined by you, sir, by Mr. Mark Gallagher. Hello, Mark.
Hello, how are you? Great to have the opportunity to speak with you.
Great to have the opportunity to speak with you. We met in Mönchengladbach when you were here with David Coulthard and had a great evening of stories of Formula One. And actually, I have to thank our listener, Jens, who said, you need to get Mark on the show, you need to get Mark on the show. And then right before you were leaving, I had the guts to ask if you were willing to do this interview, and I'm very happy that we can do it now. We don't have a world champion as of right now. The United States Grand Prix was last night. Lewis Hamilton was not able to secure his fifth championship. You've watched the race, of course. You are a television expert for BBC, for ESPN, Sky Sports, F1, and whoever wants to have you as an expert on. What did you think of the race?
It was really exciting. I have to say, it's always great when you've worked in a sport like Formula One for such a long time to then see a race which makes you feel like a kid again. You know, I was so excited to watch how the race unfolded, the different strategies, Max Verstappen coming from 18th on the grid, getting into a podium finish and eventually second place. I mean, amazing drive from him. Of course, Kimi Raikkonen winning the race. I mean, I think we all have a soft spot for Kimi. He's such an interesting personality and, of course, a legendary driver within Formula One. So from every perspective, I found the United States Grand Prix absolutely fascinating and thrilling. And Lewis Hamilton will be 5 times world champion. The fact that it has been delayed by a short time, probably until Mexico, you know, it's a little pity for him. I'm sure he'd like to win in America, but I think it's good for Formula One. We had a great day, and I think the fans will enjoy that result.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it all stands and falls, as we say in Germany. I don't know if you can say this in English, but I do.
Yeah, you can, yeah.
Okay. With Sebastian Vettel and his trials and tribulations over the season. Last night in German time, again, he made a mistake. Well, did he really make a mistake? He had oversteering or understeering and spun in his battle with Daniel Ricciardo. But it's yet again another step in the path of mistakes that Ferrari has made, that he has made, that finally will cost him his world championship that many thought he had secured over the beginning of the season.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, Sebastian, clearly one of the greatest drivers of the modern era, but has had a tough second half of this season. And as he said last night after the United States Grand Prix, he is fed up having to do the comeback drive after a spin or an accident at the start of the race. And I think this is one of the difficulties of the penalty system and of drivers ending up in a position where, instead of being in the front row when things tend to be easier, if you end up on the third row or the fourth row or behind, you're going to be battling people on the first lap. And I think for someone like Sebastian, yes, there have been some mistakes. I think part of it is also frustration because he's trying to get back up towards the front of the field. It was very exactly as you say, Kevin. It was interesting to watch the replay of the Vettel Ricciardo accident because the collision between them, because actually it wasn't really Sebastian's fault. It wasn't really Daniel's fault. Sebastian had a oversteer moment. He caught the car. You can see on the camera he has to adjust the steering wheel coming through the corner to correct the slide. And because he had to do that, he then goes towards Daniel's car, and of course they touch, and it costs Sebastian a spin. So it was a racing accident. Very frustrating for him. Very frustrating for Daniel Ricciardo, I think, too, to be involved in that. But it's just been typical of Sebastian's season. And I, you know, I posted a kind of funny image on Twitter at the weekend about, you know, Sebastian, I'm sure he cannot wait to get home after Abu Dhabi and to finish this season, because it's been such a disappointment in the end. I mean, he must feel so frustrated with what's happened. So it's been an interesting few months, really. You know, going back to July, to the mistake he made in the wet in Germany, and then there's just been other little problems. And I think the difficulty that Sebastian and the Ferrari team have is that they are racing against a guy, Lewis Hamilton, who is at the top of his game, probably driving the best he's ever driven. They're also driving against Lewis Hamilton at a time when he is clearly number one in the Mercedes team by a significant margin. He's got no pressure or threat from Bottas. So Lewis is on his own. He's out in front. The Mercedes team give him every support. And, of course, it's a great car. And I think the Mercedes management structure and the leadership at Mercedes is probably slightly stronger than Ferrari. So yeah, there are a lot of reasons why Lewis Hamilton has an advantage and why Sebastian Vettel maybe is not so fortunate in his position.
Do you see any changes coming to Ferrari? Because we have a recurring situation right now with Ferrari this season. It was basically the same as it happened last season. It was very, very good until the summer break, and then after Singapore, it all went awry. And Maurizio Arrabeni, the team principal, always says, if there is a fault to be given to someone, it should be me. I am responsible for this. And he is responsible for not putting the team on the level that Toto Wolff is doing with Mercedes, not giving team orders, straight team orders to Kimi Räikkönen when it was necessary to do them for Ferrari. And yeah, it's not the first year that Maurizio Arrabeni made mistakes that will cost Ferrari not only the Drivers' Championship, but the more important championship, the Constructors' Championship. Does there need to be a change for 2019, because his position is not strengthened at all with what is happening right now? Or do you think that Ferrari needs to stay calm and keep Maurizio working?
So this is a really key question. There is a lot of opinion within Formula One that Ferrari might go through another management change this winter, and Mr. Binotto, who was previously the head of the engine department, I mean, he looks like being a possible candidate to become a team principal in the future. I personally feel stability is usually better than change in a situation where a team is under pressure. I think when you have this kind of situation where things have gone wrong in some large ways and some small ways this year. I mean, you talk about the strategy decisions. For me, the start of the race in Monza was a really key moment in this season, because if Mr. Arrivabene had got the kind of control over the team that Toto Wolff has at Mercedes-Benz, I think Maurizio would have been able to sit down with Kimi and with Sebastian and say, look, we're not racing each other. We're trying to beat Lewis Hamilton in the championship. Therefore, this is what we need to do on the opening lap and to get Kimi's buy-in. And I think, as it turns out, they instead decided to tell Kimi on the Sunday morning that he was not going to be staying in the team next year and that he'd be moving to Sauber. So I think the timing of that was very unfortunate. And then because Kimi didn't really help Sebastian on the opening lap, it was so clear that Lewis was going to get a run at Sebastian on the opening lap. So, you know, there are some pretty practical things there which are difficult. Now, here's what I will say to you. Maurizio Arrivabene is a commercial guy. He comes from a commercial background at Philip Morris, the owner of the Marlboro brand, which has been a sponsor of Ferrari for such a long time. And I have a lot of sympathy for Maurizio, because I also have come from a commercial background, and I know what it's like when you are trying to run an engineering business such as a racing team, but you actually are not an engineer. You don't come from sort of the necessary background, and it can be difficult. It really can. It can be a struggle to get the respect of all of the engineers. It can be difficult to get it can even be difficult to fully understand all the things that are happening unless you are an engineering expert. Now, this is not to say that you need to be a top engineer to run a Formula One team, but it definitely helps if you have been working in the industry all your career. He has not been, you know, he's relatively new to this role. And I think that that must be a big challenge for him. So I have a little bit of sympathy. I think stability should be important, but that is only going to work. It is genuinely only going to work if the team can sit down and have an honest, open, transparent conversation about everything that has happened this year, about the driver orders, about the race strategies, about the way in which the car has been developed, about Sebastian's mistakes. That means everyone needs to be able to sit down, not blaming people, just talking about it. How do we make sure that in 2019, with Sebastian, with Charles Leclerc, we do not have a repeat of this season? We want to win the championship. And if they are unable to do that, if they're unable to have that open, honest discussion, if there are egos involved, if there are reasons why people don't want to share the information in the right way, then unfortunately Ferrari are going to continue to struggle and not be in a position to win the world championship. And I think as a final point to my long answer to your question, there is no doubt that I feel very strongly about this. Ferrari have gone down the wrong strategy with the way they handle their involvement in Formula One. This is the most famous team in the world. They should be open with the media. They should be open with the fans. They need to put on a friendlier face, I think, to the world. I think Toto Wolff and the Mercedes-Benz team do this very well. I think Red Bull does it very well. You can be a friendly and open and approachable team without giving away your secrets, without giving up your competitive position. I feel like Ferrari are so tense as a company. They're so tense about everything they're doing. It doesn't help them to flow freely and to get the results that they want. And I really wish that they would change their strategy as a business in overall terms, because, again, we all love Ferrari in some way because, you know, it's such an important team within the sport. And it's really disappointing to see them struggling once again for reasons which I think have a lot to do with the culture of the organization, not with the people, not with the technology, not with the facilities, not with the budget. They have everything on paper required to win the world championship. I think it's the culture that's holding them back.
Sei dein eigener Programmchef. Mit unserer neuen meinsportradio.de App wählst du jetzt zwischen allen Livestreams und Podcasts. Einfach, immer, überall. Hol dir unsere neue App für iOS und Android und bewerte sie jetzt bei Google Play und im App Store von iTunes.
Die Zirbelnuss ist eine Wappenfigur in Form des...
Auf die Zirbelnuss, der FC Augsburg Talk auf meinsportradio.de.
You brought up some very, very, very interesting points, which I would like to go in a little bit about. You said that you don't need to be an engineer to run a good Formula One business or a team, but do you need to be a racer to run a good Formula One team? Toto Wolff has been, Christian Horner has been, Frank Williams in his prime has been. I don't know if Ron Dennis ever did, but do you need to have that? Or if you are like Ron Dennis, do you need to have a hard hand, which Arrivo Benny really doesn't seem to show, which he could have shown with Kimi, and the turning point in my estimation still it was when we were able to see in full detail on television that the team was not very much on one level, is when Kimi was told he should make space for Sebastian Vettel, but he always asked back, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? Just say it. And that shows me that there are some problems. So back to my question, do you need to be a racer to run a good Formula One team these days?
It's essential that you are a racer, and it's essential that you understand racing and have... And when I say understand racing, this means not just what happens on a racetrack and how you make decisions. Also understand that when you employ someone to do a job, it's really important to just let them get on with it. And if you, especially if you're a non-technical person, you need to respect the fact that, you know, you need to allow people the freedom to operate. And I think it's pretty clear that at Mercedes they have that ability, and I think Toto is an extremely good leader. I don't know Maurizio Arrivabene at all. We've never had reason to work together. I know that, you know, he comes from a corporate background. I'm surprised that the philosophy that the team has had over the last couple of years has been, for example, to limit the media to not be as open as other teams. And I feel that when you have that closed environment, it's never a good sign. Plus, we've also had some indication in the last 2 or 3 years of the fact that, you know, people can be put out of their job at Ferrari if there's a disagreement within the team or the management. Now, that can happen in any organization, but I feel like stability is such an important thing in top teams. When you start losing people like James Allison, who, you know, was put out of the Ferrari team, and I mean, James is a super guy, and he had just been through a personal tragedy with the loss of his wife, his young wife. And, you know, the Sergio Marchionne, the former chief executive of Ferrari, apparently he and James kind of couldn't agree on future terms. So I suppose the point I'm making is there has been some instability. There has been a little bit of lack of happiness in terms of the overall culture within the business. Again, going back to Maurizio, I don't know whether he's a racer or not. He's been involved in motor racing for quite a long time because he was actually Philip Morris's representative on the World Motorsport Council before he became the boss of Ferrari. So he clearly is very familiar with the racing world. I think there are a couple of points that I will make about being a boss of a team. You have to recognize that it's important to have the freedom for you to do the job. So when you are the boss, when you are the team boss, you should be allowed to get on with your job. Now, Maurizio Arrivabene was not given the freedom to do that while Sergio Marchionne was around. Sergio would go to races, he would have press conferences, he would make public statements. It became very clear that actually Maurizio Arrivabene's job was to carry out the strategy of the real boss, which was Sergio Marchionne. And I think that was a bad thing. I think that undermined Maurizio in the eyes of the media and probably in the eyes of some people inside Ferrari. So I feel, again, I feel some regret for him that he didn't have the freedom to do his job. I think the second thing really then is, you know, as a team boss, you need to just let people make decisions. And that means being able to make brave decisions, being able to do the thing which requires some courage. Now, that might mean that you sit down with the two drivers on a Saturday evening and you have a difficult conversation. But you have to have those conversations on a Saturday night. You can't have those conversations on the radio during the race. So exactly as your point, Kevin, when Kimi Raikkonen comes on the radio and says, just tell me what you want me to do, you know, it's kind of clear that they didn't have the necessary conversations before the race, and there is some uncertainty. And I think that is inexcusable. There has to be, in a team, the ability for the boss to sit people down and say, listen, guys, this is what we have to do tomorrow. One of you is going to be happy. The other one is not going to be happy, but we have to think about the team. And this is, and then have the discussion and get it all done before the race starts. And I think if that's not happening, that shows again that there is a degree of tension within the team, and maybe that the communications are not flowing in the way that they should. And that's again, another reason why Ferrari finds themselves in the position of being the second best team in Formula One when obviously they want to be the best.
How long do you think Ferrari, or I ask this differently, do you think Ferrari would really ever genuinely considering leaving Formula One if they are not able to beat Mercedes, let's say, until 2020?
No, I don't think Ferrari will ever give up Formula One. I think that they are currently going through another cycle, and it's a kind of downward cycle, which is a period of some disappointment. And I think the leadership in Ferrari, and by that I don't mean Maurizio Arrivabene, I mean the shareholders and the owners within the Fiat Chrysler Group, they will eventually realize that there's something not working within the Ferrari organization if they don't win the world championship in the next 2 years. I think the next big change, if they need a big change, the next big change should come at the end, towards the end of the current regulations in 2020, because if next year Hamilton wins his sixth world championship, which I have to say, you know, I can't think any reason why he won't be going for it again, you know, Ferrari could easily face another 2 years without winning. Of course, the other problem that they have is that next year you're going to have Max Verstappen and Pierre Gasly in two Red Bull Hondas. And I think if the Honda engine has made the progress that Red Bull are saying, it could be pretty extraordinary. I mean, Max drove an amazing race yesterday. The car chassis and its aerodynamics are obviously fantastic. They just need a little bit more engine power. And if the Honda is getting towards a Mercedes-Ferrari engine power, then, you know, I think Max will benefit from that. Of course, Honda also will be bringing them additional budget, so there'll be even more research and development going into the car. So Ferrari actually, in my view, next year, of course, they'll want to attack Mercedes again. I think Ferrari will have an even bigger problem next year keeping Red Bull behind. So, yeah, big changes maybe for Ferrari in a couple of years' time. I just wish they would collectively take a step back and look at the big picture the way that you and I and the fans and the media do about Ferrari. It's such a fantastic team with a great heritage, and it's just a pity that for cultural reasons, they're just holding themselves back.
Let's leave the current Formula One aside a little bit and talk about you. You have such an amazing CV over your time in Formula One. Let's start at the very beginning. What was the allure for you to go into the business of Formula One?
Well, when I was 8 years old, which was 1970, and Jochen Rindt was winning the world championship, I happened to watch a Formula One race on television. It was in black and white television, and the driver leading the race was Jackie Stewart, and also Emerson Fittipaldi was there, and I just remember it so clearly. And from that moment on, I was hooked. I loved Formula One. So when I came out of university, I was very lucky to get a job working for Autosport magazine in London, which is a top motor racing magazine. And working in the media was a great way to start my career, because I'm not an engineer. I wanted to get into the, you know, the non-technical side of the sport, the commercial side. And so that was the beginning of my career. And I worked in the media but also I worked on PR, public relations work, for about 7 years. And I met some amazing people during that time and built a really strong network. And I think for anyone who wants to work in Formula One or top-level motorsport, it's all about taking opportunities and building your network. And then it's amazing what happens over a short period of time. So that's how I got started. But it all goes back to 1970 and watching Jackie Stewart and Emerson Fittipaldi.
And then what brought you together with Eddie Jordan in 1991?
So again, it was interesting. When I was a kid, I started going to races in my home country, which is Ireland. And in Ireland at that time, we had two racetracks. And one was in the north of Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, and the other one was in the Republic of Ireland. And so I used to go to those races, from school. I would go at weekends. And when I was 14, I saw this amazing racing driver. He was very competitive. He raced a car called a Formula Atlantic car, which is kind of like Formula 2. And his name was Eddie Jordan. And I asked him for his autograph, and I won't tell you what he said to me in reply, but it was very rude. He was a little bit busy, so he didn't want to sign autographs. So that was the first time I met Eddie. And then when I started working in racing in the 80s, part of the public relations work that I did was for Philip Morris. It was for Marlboro, and I got to know Eddie Irvine very well. In fact, Eddie Irvine became a lodger in my house. So he was renting a room in my house, which was in England by that stage. And so Eddie Jordan really wanted Eddie Irvine to come and drive for him in Formula 3. And so he called me. So Eddie just called me one day and said, "Hi, Mark, it's I understand Eddie Irvine's living with you, and can you help me with getting some Marlboro sponsorship?" And so the relationship began. So we started getting to know each other, and Eddie could see that I was doing a lot of work with sponsors, with media, with that non-technical side of racing. So when he started the Jordan Formula One team in 1990, he asked me if I would handle the media to start with. And I remember writing the first press release to announce the creation of Jordan Grand Prix. And then we started working together on a more full-time basis, starting with the first season in Formula One, which of course was an amazing year because we had the Jordan Ford 191 car, which was a fantastic car. We finished fifth in the World Championship at our first attempt. And, of course, during the course of that season, we found a young German guy called Michael Schumacher. And the rest of that story, of course, I think we all know.
Hören, was andere denken. meinsportradio.de.
Du kannst das Knockout kriegen.
Oder das App. Jetzt. Mein Lieblingspodcast auf meinsportradio.de.
Hallo, hier ist Malte Asmus. Jeden Montag hörst du mich zusammen mit Desiree Wolf und Thomas Wischnewski bei Nur Golf. Nur Golf ist für dich der Double Albatross unter den Sportpodcasts? Dann gib uns dein Feedback auf iTunes und bewerte Nur Golf mit 5 Sternen.
Dir gefällt, was du hörst? Dann rezensiere unsere Sendungen jetzt auf iTunes und gib ihnen 5 Sterne.
The time when you went to Jordan and you worked there in 1991 and then again from 1995 to 2004 as the head of marketing, you worked in Formula One at, I would say, the most prosperous time in Formula One. Not only in the media in Germany, Formula One was everywhere, and of course because of Michael, and a little bit because of Ralph and Heinz Harald Frentzen, who all drove for Jordan. Funny enough. What was the key to success for the Jordan Formula One team, in your opinion? I mean, many teams have come to Formula One and have gone, but Jordan was a real staple for a certain time in Formula One. Was it Eddie Jordan's mentality to go about things? And how would you say you benefited the team during your time?
Well, good question. So I think I'm going to go back to the point we discussed earlier in the podcast, which is about being a racer. And Eddie Jordan is a racer. And he had been a very successful driver in Formula Atlantic and Formula 3. He had raced in sports cars. And then he decided he was not quick enough, and he became a team owner in Formula 3. But I think the fact that Eddie had been a driver meant that he understood the fundamental requirements of being a winner. He knew what it took. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is Eddie is a businessman, and he knows that we are not going to achieve anything if we don't have the money. And money is sometimes a dirty word in racing, but you need the money to go racing, to employ the best engineers, to buy the right equipment, to build the best cars. So other than Eddie being a racer, the second reason why he was always going to make a success of Formula One was that he was a businessman. And I can tell you that, I'll tell you two things about Jordan. First of all, every morning we had a meeting to talk about money. And we talked about where the next deals were coming from, how we were going to get them. There were three of us who worked on sponsorship at Jordan. There was Eddie Jordan, there was myself, there was Ian Phillips, who was, Ian Phillips used to be the boss of the Leighton House March Formula One team back in the 1980s, and Ian's a super guy with a fantastic network. So Ian and Eddie and I, every morning we would talk about the deals that we were doing and how we would get them and how much money we could generate, and it was like a sales conference meeting every morning. So there was a big focus on getting the money in. And the second thing that Eddie would do is when we would have a meeting, a management meeting, he would look at how much money was available and he would say, okay, what do we have to spend to make the car go faster? And what do we have to spend on other things within the business? So there was basically two lists. There was a list of things that made the car go faster, and then there was a list of other things. And that shows the racer's, you know, mentality. He wanted to try and find the way to make the car go quickly. And so we had this racing team, which was full of racing people who were really focused on being competitive. We had a great family. We had a great family atmosphere in the team. I mean, we all knew each other, and we were eating together, traveling together, working together every day. And I think it was quite a small team, so therefore we had short lines of communication. You know, you didn't have to have, you know, if I wanted to have a meeting with Eddie, I could go and walk into his office, say, Eddie, we're having a problem with this. Can you give me a decision? This meant it was a very fast-moving organization. So the culture was really good, and that helped us to be, you know, super successful, I think, over the number of years. It wasn't always easy. We had bad seasons, of course, but I think I'm right in saying in 15 years of Formula One, 12 years we made a profit as a team, and there are not many private teams that made a profit that many years. So it was a well-run business. In terms of my contribution, I think I would like, it's probably better for other people. Maybe you should ask Eddie Jordan what my contribution was. But I mean, I think that my contribution to the team was very much because I was running the marketing and the commercial and the sponsorship side. I decided I had a really important role to play in creating the right image for the team. So we were very media friendly. You know, we very much the opposite of what I was talking about Ferrari earlier on. So if a journalist came along and asked us for an interview, we would really try and make sure it happened. We love to do crazy things. You know, we like to do things that were a little bit different. And so if a journalist or a television company or a radio broadcaster had some crazy idea, they wanted to have someone drive our car, or they wanted to come to our factory and do some kind of interview or some feature, then we would really try very hard to accommodate that. And also with our sponsors, you know, we could not promise our sponsors that we would win the world championship, but we could promise our sponsors that on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, every week, we would work really hard to give them satisfaction about the activities around the sponsorship to make them as happy as possible as our sponsors. So we attracted a lot of sponsors who found us a very good team to work for. And then finally, with the fans, you know, we worked really hard to keep our fans happy. We had a very good fan club, and I personally really enjoyed all the fan engagement, because it's great fun, you know. The fan, I mean, I was a fan. Eddie used to be a fan. We all were fans when we were kids. So we took this attitude that if you keep the fans happy, the fans tend to make a big noise. You know, if they really like you, the fans tend to really get behind the team. And then the sponsors see that, and also the media sees it. So you get a very strong feeling around the team. It's a popular team and it's got a lot of support. So that's really what I brought. I think I tried to bring that to it, and it was a very enjoyable period, a very enjoyable experience, and one that I look back on very, very positively.
Did you bring on Katie Price?
I didn't bring on Katie Price, although I can tell you that she did get changed in my office one morning, which was quite a distraction, because I was actually working in my office at the time, and she told me not to look. So that was quite amusing. But she, you know, Katie Price and all the other models that we used for those photo shoots back in the late 1990s, that was all part of a marketing strategy by our tobacco sponsor at Benson and Hedges. They had made a deal with the United Kingdom's largest newspaper organization. So and this newspaper always liked to have photographs of models, and so they did a deal where they would use the Jordan team to create all of these photographs, etc. And it was at a time when that kind of imagery and that kind of marketing was still regarded by companies as something that they were prepared to do. It wouldn't happen these days. I don't think that would be possible.
No. Let's talk about sponsors, and you brought up the name, perfect segue for my next question. Benson and Hedges with Jordan. We had Marlboro with Ferrari. We had Rothmans with Williams. We had West with McLaren. We had Mile 7 with Renault Benetton. We had, what was it, the Lucky Strike with BAR Honda, where you worked again as well. You get Drift. It was a smoky business. It was a smoky business in Formula One when we talked about money. Has Formula One ever overcome the breakdown in tobacco money when we see that so many teams have so much trouble to get viable sponsors and financially strong sponsors to support the team? And if you see a team like McLaren, who have to make a short-term deal with Coca-Cola, it's good to have them, but they are not sponsoring the whole season, just coming in for a few races. And otherwise, the car is very, very empty.
Yeah, I'm really pleased you asked this question, Kevin, because I think one of the most surprising aspects of Formula One over the last 13 years is how seldom people talk about the fact that the sport has never recovered from the loss of tobacco sponsorship. And I feel very strongly about that. I think the business model of Formula One broke. I think we are now in what I would call a post-sponsorship era of Formula One. Sponsorship has a role to play. You know, definitely sponsorship will continue, but sponsorship is not going to provide a team with 80 to 90% of its revenue in the way that we used to 20 years ago. I can tell you, at Jordan Grand Prix, we used to generate a budget of around, if we call the budget 100 million euros. So, I mean, it's extraordinary to think, but, you know, more than 20 years ago, we were generating the budget that Force India is running on today. So in real terms, we had a lot more money, and only about 20% of that was coming from Bernie Eccleston, from Formula One and the TV revenue. So 80% of our money was coming from sponsors like Benson and Hedges, MasterCard, Infineon, Lucent Technologies, Hewlett-Packard, Sony PlayStation, Honda, Bridgestone. You know, we had a huge amount of sponsors bringing money in, and tobacco was at the top of that. And the sport has never recovered from that. And I think what is quite shocking is that a number of teams have failed to reduce their expenditure in the post-tobacco era. And I think there are some teams in Formula One today which are too big, and they're still trying to spend money in the way that they used to spend money going back to the tobacco era. And it's my personal opinion. I'm a very big supporter of all teams in Formula One. I think they all do an amazing job. But my personal opinion is that McLaren would have been a better team if they had become a smaller team in recent years. I think the Williams team would also have benefited from that. I think that if I was on the board of directors of McLaren or Williams, I would look at Force India and I would say to myself, how can this team, with half the number of staff, with a factory that would hardly fit inside the McLaren canteen, how can they be so consistently competitive for fourth or fifth place in the world championship? And again, it goes back to culture. It goes back to how you spend money. It goes back to very basic decisions that are made. So I, 100% agree that the sport has not recovered commercially from the loss of tobacco sponsorship. There are lots of other ways to make money now, but I think teams have to reduce expenditure in order to develop a sustainable business model. And I think for some of them, that's proving to be almost impossible. They're finding it almost an impossible thing to do. I really don't think that we will ever come back to a position where we will have one industry like tobacco sponsoring Formula One in a big way. The problem is that tobacco companies had to sponsor Formula One because there was no other sport that they could sponsor. They weren't permitted to sponsor football. They couldn't sponsor athletics. They couldn't sponsor lots of other major sports. So they chose Formula One, and we benefited from it for 40 years. But it wasn't morally a great thing for us to be doing. I never felt comfortable about it, but we took the money. We are mercenary. We took the money, and we were very happy to get it when we had it. But it's not there anymore. It's never going to come back. And I think the sport needs to be a little bit more creative in the respect of how it makes its money.
Do you think Formula One is a mainstream sport or a niche sport?
Wow. It should be a mainstream sport. I fear that in many markets it has become a niche sport. And I was in my home country, Ireland, yesterday, actually, speaking at a conference. And there were 250 people in the audience. And I asked, how many of you are Formula One fans? And there were six. So there were six people out of 250. So that's, about 2% of the audience. And that's shocking, because 20 years ago, I would say I would have had 40%. And we have lost the audience in my home country because we don't have an Irish team anymore. We don't have Jordan Grand Prix. We don't have an Irish driver. We don't have Eddie Irvine. And the television companies in Ireland have stopped showing Formula One completely. So if you want to watch Formula One in my home country, you have to get a subscription to a British broadcaster, which is Sky. And to do that, you have to live in a certain part of the country to get the full benefit. So, I see this all over the world. I go to a lot of countries where I speak to companies and I speak to organizations, and I find not many people are big fans of Formula One anymore. And the other thing that happens a great deal, and it's, I really wish sometimes that I had Chase Carey or Sean Bratches from Formula One with me. I meet senior business people. I'm talking like chief executives. I meet a lot of chief executives and a lot of top business people who are my age. They're in their 50s, or maybe they're older, but they're in their 60s. And they come up to me and they say, "Oh, you know, it's really great to meet you. I used to love Formula One. You know, I used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to watch Australian Grand Prix. And yeah, it used to be so fantastic and I really enjoyed it." And then I say to them, "Oh, so you don't watch it anymore?" And they go, "No, it's boring. You know, we know who's going to win. It's not very exciting. Seeing people win every weekend and the races are not so dramatic." And that's it. And for me, that's really a tragedy because the sport's killed itself in so many ways by following an obsession with digital technology to the point where the race is predicted by a computer. And as long as Lewis Hamilton doesn't make a mistake, generally he's going to win the race. And this is why Sebastian Vettel is kind of so unusual, because he's a human being who's making mistakes this year. So it's kind of a shock to the system. But in the digital world that Formula One is now, the cars are 90% reliable. The race, they are almost 100% safe. So there's no sense of risk and there's no sense of unpredictability. There's just a sense of safety and there's a sense of complete predictability. And I think for any sport, if you have a predictable outcome, people are not so interested.
90 plus on air. Der Podcast rund um den internationalen Fußball auf meinsportradio.de.
Hallo liebe Hörer, mein Name ist Yannick Lebherz. Ich bin Schwimmer der deutschen Nationalmannschaft und ich höre meinsportradio.de.
Hören, was andere denken auf meinsportradio.de.
We have a lot of questions from our Facebook fans or Facebook group, and I would like to give you one from Alexander. What would be your ideas to get younger fans to become fans of Formula One and keep them fans of Formula One? We always talk about how you can get in touch with drivers, which is very important for many fans. I was in Hungary this year, and we did the pit walk. Me and my best friend, we did the pit walk. And me and my best friend, knowing how this is going, you will never ever see any driver. But there were little fans, little children, little kids that were crying because they were hoping to get to see a driver and they wouldn't. And it broke my heart, actually. And what would be your ideas to get younger fans in touch, but also keep the fans that were there and that left? How can we do that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big point. Thanks, Alexander, for the question. So when I go back to my time, I talked to you about my time at Jordan. At Jordan, we were very fan friendly. I was on the management board. I was marketing director of the company, and I used to go into the pit lane during the pit lane walkabout. And what I always really enjoyed doing was picking up a kid in the crowd. I would go over to a mother and a father who'd have a little boy or a little girl, and I would say, "Would you like to come into the garage?" And of course, people were always just completely shocked and say, "Wow, really? Are you sure?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And I remember a number of times bringing young kids into the garage and then asking the mechanics, "Is it okay if they sit in the car?" And the mechanics said, most times the mechanics are not working on the cockpit, so they say, "Yeah, sure, no problem." And you put the kids in the car and the parents take a photograph, and it costs zero. It costs absolutely nothing. And it generates a fan for life. You know, it becomes something people, I know those families will still have those photographs. So for me, it's all about fan engagement. And I personally think that there should be a public pit lane walkabout every day at every Grand Prix. There's nothing to stop us doing that. People talk about security. Security can always be managed. Of course, under Bernie Eccleston, he wanted to create a situation where everybody had to pay a lot of money for everything. I understand that. Bernie did a fantastic job. He's an amazing guy. He created a great business. But he really did not give the opportunity for fans to get close to the sport. And, you know, when I started working in Formula One, I remember even as a fan, but when I started working at Formula One in 1983, you could buy a ticket to get into the pits. You know, you could walk into the pits between sessions and you could see Nigel Mansell and Nelson Piquet and Ayrton Senna and all these guys, and you could see them up close. And I think, again, it comes back to the culture of any business. You have to decide what you want to be. Do you want to be a sport where the drivers are remote, or do you want to be a sport where the drivers are accessible to the fans? I also feel very strongly about the fact that the teams and the sponsors these days spend a lot of money on PR, creating, you know, viral videos and sort of funny content for the internet, and getting Daniel Ricciardo and Max Verstappen to do crazy things so that Red Bull gets some funny video for their social media platform. In my opinion, that's completely the wrong philosophy. Ayrton Senna and Michael Schumacher would never have done that because they were serious professional drivers. I think it's really important that we make drivers into the heroes, that we turn them into people that are like almost like gods to their fans, the way that it was in my time. And I think at the moment they actually try to make the drivers into looking like kids sometime. I'm not sure that's the right approach. So I think the teams and the sponsors should get serious about turning the drivers into heroes. And then Formula One should get serious about giving the members of the public access to the teams, the cars, the drivers, up close, personal. The fans are not going to steal anything. They're not going to set fire to the garage. There's not going to be a riot. There's just going to be thousands of fans enjoying the sport up close. And the final thing I'll say in answer to Alexander's question, you know, Formula One's already doing some amazing things with esports, with online gaming, and also with social media access to the sport. And I think they need to keep doing that more and more and more. I think for the young fans, the experience of Formula One, you should be able to watch it. You should be able to play it. You should be able to engage with it. When you go to a race, you should be able to meet it up close. And for me, there is so much to be done in that space. And I think Liberty will get there because they are, you know, the Liberty is the owner of Formula One. They will get there because they're a commercial organization. They're on a big learning curve at the moment, but I really do believe they will eventually understand that the sport is nothing if it doesn't work for the fans.
You say that Formula One needs to be seen by the fans. In many, many countries, it's a big problem to see Formula One racing, where pay TV and subscription-based outlets have the rights to broadcast Formula One. Like in the UK, yeah, it's a big problem. In Germany, we have RTL, but we had Sky. Now, we can have F1 TV subscribe to the Liberty service if we want to. The whole TV situation, how do you see that working for TV stations around Formula One in the world?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I would, you know, it would be lovely if it'd be great if Formula One was free on television for everyone to watch. And honestly, I don't see that happening again. And I think that's not unique to Formula One. I think all sports are facing this kind of challenge. So again, if we take a really big step back, if we step away from Formula One for a moment, the world of media is changing. My family in here, and we live in England, my family here, my kids don't watch television, and they stopped watching television about 6 or 7 years ago. So they consume everything online, and they are multimedia, you know, multimedia consumers. So it's about online content, it's about gaming, it's about streaming, and we know that that's being replicated across all countries around the world. And so what we now have is a very fragmented audience, and the sport has to somehow reach out to fans and give them a way of following the sport in an economic way. And I personally believe that the strategy that's being followed by Liberty is probably the right one. So in essence, you develop three three channels for following Formula One. You have a free to air channel, which is probably showing highlights and definitely showing some races live. Maybe, you know, half the races or a quarter of the races are live, but free to air definitely has a role to play, because free to air means you generate as many fans as possible by making it free and accessible. The second way is you have a pay platform where people who are really big into sport generally, who want to watch football, who want to watch Bundesliga, who want to watch golf and tennis, you know, they can subscribe to a sports platform which includes Formula One. So I think that's your second thing. That's for the really crazy sports fan who wants to pay quite a lot of money each month because they want to watch lots of different sports. And then the third way is you have a dedicated streaming service for Formula One, the Formula One TV system. If we had that in the UK, I know I would subscribe to it. I know, you know, all my friends would subscribe to it, because I'm not really interested in other sports. So I don't want to subscribe to Sky and watch and pay for golf and tennis and football. I'm not interested. I just want to watch Formula One. The other thing is, when I watch Formula One, I want to watch it in any country. So I travel a great deal. And when I go to Spain or Germany or France or Japan or China, I can't watch Formula One on my laptop or my iPad, because if I'm just a Sky customer, it's geo-blocked to the UK. So again, the F1 subscription service opens that up. And I think that three-platform approach, free-to-air, pay-per-view, and the subscription service to Formula One, should provide something for everyone in the future. And I don't think that that will be unique to Formula One. I think it'll be repeated for other sports. And I think it's just the way that media will be consumed in the 21st century. My wife has a Netflix subscription because she likes watching movies on Netflix. You know, she's happy to pay whatever the Netflix subscription is every month. I'm happy to pay whatever the Formula One subscription is. So I think, you know, the reality is that the world has changed, and Formula One just needs to find its right level within that.
Is F1 TV a big issue in the paddock when you are there? Do people know about that in the business? And I am a subscriber of F1 TV, but to be honest, the incentives are not really there. Okay, we can watch all the sessions of Formula One, but when you see that you cannot watch the Formula 2, not watch the GP3, you get the commentary that is from Sky, from RTL, so no exclusively dedicated commentary to F1 TV. You don't have the pre-show, post-show stuff. Formula One is doing a lot of on YouTube with Will Buxton, and this is really fine and dandy, but I'm not paying for this. So do you think that they need to give more incentives to really subscribe to F1 TV?
Yeah, I think ultimately F1 TV will become as good as any of the dedicated sports channels like RTL or Sky. And I think what you're seeing at the moment, Kevin, is chapter one of a big evolution for Formula One. I think the first thing to do was to launch the platform and to enable people to watch Formula One through streaming. I think it's, of course, really important that the economics of it work, and I'm sure the economics of it will work. I think they will build a very good subscriber base over time, and then as the economics work, they will be able to spend money on getting a dedicated set of commentators, because I agree with you. I think that stealing the commentary team from Sky or RTL it's not ideal, because you're only getting one perspective. And I think Formula One TV needs to have a different perspective. And then definitely you need to see Formula 2, Formula 3, or GP3, the support races. Actually, ultimately, what F1 TV should be is it should be the same as being in the paddock at a Formula One race for the weekend. It should be something that you could watch all weekend, and really, it's like being there. And I'm sure that is what will develop. So within Formula One, what I would say is people were really shocked at how quickly Liberty got this up and running. I mean, we're only in year two. I mean, this is, you know, Eccleston only disappeared in January 2017. Here we are in October 2018, and Liberty have already got a number of things underway. So they're moving pretty quickly. They know that some of it is not perfect. They know there's a lot of development to do, but I'm optimistic. I think these guys are very serious. I think they've employed good people. I think they're pushing to make the sport and a lot more accessible to fans. And hopefully we will see more big developments over the next two or three years, because I really do want Formula One to become, you know, very popular and accessible again to as many people as possible.
Jens is asking, the one who's responsible for this interview, if you could turn back time in Formula One to one point of your career when you were working in Formula One, where would you go and what would you change at that moment?
Wow. Now, that's a Jens, you're a crazy guy. That's a fantastic question. Gosh, basically you're asking me if I could rewrite history, okay? So, yeah. I mean, I could be very philosophical about this. I could tell you that I really wish that I could go back to Saturday morning in San Marino 1994 and tell Roland Ratzenberger that when he went off the track that he should come into the pits and get the front wing checked and not go onto a flying lap, because if Roland had come back into the pits and checked the front wing after going off the track, the team might have found the crack and then he might never have lost his life. And I really believe if Roland Ratzenberger had not lost his life, I it's just a feeling I have. I think if that had not happened to Roland, I think Ayrton Senna would still be with us, because I think that Ayrton was in a very difficult place in his mind mentally on Sunday, the 1st of May, 1994. So if I could go back and do one thing differently, it would be to make sure that both those guys were still with us, to do something that would change that. But that's a kind of deep philosophical answer to the question. So the fun answer to the question is I wish that I could have got on the radio to Heinz Harald Frentzen at the Nürburgring in 1999 when he was leaving the pits and told him or his engineer to remember to turn off the anti-stall system on the car, because he forgot to, he basically didn't activate the right button when he was leaving the pits and he was leading the race. So we were leading that race, and because of that the car stalled, and Heinz thought the car had suffered a failure because he couldn't find a gear. And so he retired from the race and we lost the race. Now, if we had won that race, that would have been Heinz's third race win that year. He would have been in a position to challenge for the Drivers' Championship. We would have been, I mean, it would have completely changed all our lives, because that would have been just unbelievable. And, you know, we had so many good times at Jordan. And Heinz Harald, by the way, was the most fantastic driver to work with. I loved Heinz. I loved working with him. He was just a formidably talented driver. And just one small mistake, and it cost us a race victory at Nürburgring, and it cost us the opportunity to actually challenge for the Drivers' Championship at the end of 1999.
Jens also asks, what would you say are the two biggest strategic mistakes Bernie Ecclestone and the FIA did when they were running Formula One?
Well
if you have
the
one,
biggest
one
strategic
okay.
mistakes. Well, I think, you know, in the case of the FIA, I think it was a strategic mistake to introduce the current hybrid engines in the way that they did, which was to ignore the commercial reality of having two energy systems on the car. We have the MGU-K and we have the MGU-H. The MGU-H was crazy expensive, just a complete madness. And I think that people probably don't realize what a negative effect the cost of that technology has had on the whole of Formula One. The other thing that it did was it gave Mercedes a comprehensive technical advantage at the beginning. They don't have that advantage today, but certainly at the beginning, they had such a massive advantage with that particular technology. And I think strategically, the FIA, I think Jean Todt had absolutely the right idea, which was, let's make Formula One hybrid, let's make Formula One fuel efficient, let's make Formula One a great showcase for energy efficient technology. What he was 100% right to do that. The execution was wrong, and that wasn't Jean Todt's fault. It was the fault of some of the people working with him, and it was also the fault of the engine manufacturers. The problem that the FIA has had too often in the past is that the people who sit in the room and dream up the regulations are technical. They are technologists. They are not looking at it from the point of view of the commercial reality, and they are not looking at it from the point of view of the fans. And I think it's been a real pity to kill the competitive performance of Red Bull and Renault, to kill the competitive performance of Ferrari to begin with, to actually make life very difficult for Honda when they came in. So I think that was a big strategic mistake. In regards to Bernie Ecclestone, I think the biggest mistake I think that Bernie made was in forgetting the reality of the fact that the sport needs a volume of fans and a volume of television viewers, and therefore I think he should have been forcing, whenever he took the races to new countries like Malaysia, Bahrain, Abu Dhabi, Russia, Bernie should have been creating a way for those races to make sure the grandstands are full. They should have been giving free tickets to schools. They should have been getting as many people as possible in those countries and educating them about Formula One. I think too often Bernie said, it's not my problem. You know, it's not my problem. It's someone else's problem. I mean, he was the chief executive of Formula One. So I think strategically, the biggest mistake that Bernie made was in not going far enough to ensure that the volume of spectators and the number of television viewers was protected at all costs. It's so important to keep the numbers up. And I think today we are seeing the result of a number of decisions he made strategically, which have robbed us of audiences, and that's made the sport weaker.
Daniel wants to know why private teams are in some ways looked down upon in contrast to works teams. Would it have more sense to have just private teams or just works teams? Because he, in his opinion, he thinks private teams can never really go against the works teams in the end.
Well, you see, I kind of, what I would say, that was Daniel asking the question,
right.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. So Red Bull is a private team, and, you know, it's not a works team. It's about to become a works team with, or a semi-works team with Honda, in the same way that Jordan used to have Honda engines. But, I mean, it's a private team, but of course it's a private team owned by a billionaire, Dietrich Mateschitz at Red Bull. So, I mean, I think people kind of forget about that and they say, oh, yeah, but it's Red Bull. I mean, if you look at Premiership football in the UK, or I don't know about Bundesliga, but, you know, there are a lot of millionaires and billionaires who own football teams, and no one criticizes them for owning those teams. So I think in Formula One, the private teams are still very relevant. I think private teams are looked down upon only by the manufacturer teams, and I think by some journalists. I think some of the media look down on private teams. You know, they say things like, they're only a private team. You know, well, Jordan was only a private team, and we did a pretty good job within Formula One, and I think Force India do that today. I think the Sauber team is doing a great job, and they're only privately owned. And I think that actually when you look at it, what is it that makes a works team a works team? One thing is a relationship with the car manufacturer, and the other thing is your ability to build your own engine, like Ferrari and Mercedes and Renault. And this is why I would very strongly believe that Formula One, again, with the FIA making the hybrid engine decision back in 2011, they really screwed up by pushing Cosworth out of Formula One. And I mean, they did push Cosworth. I mean, let's be clear. Cosworth was pushed out of Formula One at that time. Not by Jean Todt, I'm not blaming him, but by the regulations. So the regulations made sure that it was not commercially viable. And the difficulty is when also, you don't have a
Also by a lobby. Would you say that the other manufacturers had an interest in pushing Cosworth out a little bit?
No, sure. I mean, there's one in particular, which happens to be a French company, they had a meeting with me one day in 2010, and they told me, they were very straight. They said, we're going to steal one of your top customers, and there's nothing you can do about it because we've got the money and you don't. Huh. And that's what you're up against. You know, that's the arrogance that you're up against in Formula One as an independent supplier. A manufacturer can come in and say, we've got the money, we're going to throw some money on the table, and therefore it makes life easy. I mean, the reality is that, I mean, I obviously ran the Cosworth engine business, and I haven't worked there now for 6 years, but I'm still very passionate about Cosworth and the benefit of having an independent engine manufacturer in Formula One. The problem is, Kevin, if Donald Trump and President Putin do something next year and we have another world economic crisis and the banks all have a problem again and then the car manufacturers are losing sales, we could lose Renault and we could lose Honda from Formula One overnight. You know, we could, like happened in 2008, 2009 with BMW, Toyota and Honda. The problem is if we lose the manufacturers out of Formula One, where are the engines going to come from? And I really believe that there is a significant strength for Formula One from having an independent engine manufacturer. It means that the independent teams have a chance to do something special themselves, to work with a company which will effectively be their genuine partner, not just selling engines, but actually develop the technology solutions with them to be competitive. I think the second thing is it would be a very important political move for Formula One, because at the moment, Liberty find themselves in a position where a lot of the power lies with Mercedes-Benz, with Ferrari, with Renault particularly, because they supply the engines to all the teams. So the car manufacturers have a great deal of control over Formula One at the moment. So I think, for the future, going after 2020, I would really like to see an independent engine manufacturer return to Formula One and to work with teams. So it's a topic that I'm very passionate about. I think Formula One's made a little bit of a mistake in recent years on that front. And I think it has made the works teams like Ferrari and Mercedes look stronger, and it's made the customer teams look weaker.
Is it also a point with the tire supplier that you need more options?
Yeah, I understand the reason why a tire war is not ideal, because the difficulty with a tire war is that if we have two or three tire companies, they will have to do a lot of testing, and testing is extremely expensive, and it will drive budgets up again, and it will actually only really work for the works team. So Mercedes, if you had Pirelli and Michelin come into Formula One against each other, you could imagine Michelin partner with Mercedes, Pirelli partner with Ferrari, and then Michelin and Pirelli say, okay, these are the only teams that can win. So everyone else, they have a standard tire, and we give the special tires to Mercedes and Ferrari. So you end up with an imbalance. I think it's right that we have a standard tire for everybody. And I just wish that on the tire situation, the drivers were able to drive flat out and really to push as hard as possible. And I think when you see tire management taking place a lot, that's really disappointing. That shouldn't be what Formula One's about. And then, like Kevin Magnussen said about the United States Grand Prix, I mean, he said it was Formula Fuel save. He said in his social media, because he was having to save fuel, you know, the whole race, and then he got disqualified because he had used 0.1 kilograms of fuel too much, you know, for the race. So it's, you know, all that kind of stuff is for me the kind of things that need to be changed.
You're not a newbie to the podcast world. You have a podcast with Mika Häkkinen for yep. Unibet.
Yeah.
And Mika said that from a technical perspective, how can you develop a motor or a chassis when you don't have the opportunities to test? You can do it with computer simulations, but that's not the real world. That's what he told our colleagues from motorsporttotal.com. Although being very expensive to have testing days, do you think that there should be more options to test, which would also give young drivers the chance to get to know the car better, that mistakes like Lance Stroll did, again, with Fernando Alonso, could be prevented maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. Mika is very passionate about the fact that testing is very restricted today, which it is. Again, I come back to the cost, and I also come back to the fact that we now have 21 Grand Prix, which means there's not a lot of time for testing during the season anyway. I think there is a big opportunity to use Fridays at Formula One races a lot more creatively. I think Free Practice 1 and Free Practice 2 are not terribly exciting. I mean, I'm sure some people will remember we used to have first qualifying on a Friday, and sometimes if it was dry on a Friday and wet on a Saturday, actually it was Friday qualifying that would determine the grid. So I think there's an opportunity to do something with Fridays. I have, again, quite a strong opinion about it. I think the current Friday doesn't really do much for the fans, doesn't do much for the media. I would either get rid of it completely and just have a two-day weekend, have two practice sessions on a Saturday morning and a qualifying in the afternoon, and maybe a warm-up on the Sunday morning to give some running. Again, that we used to have warm-up on a Sunday morning, which was a great thing for fans to enjoy at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I'd either scrap Friday completely, or I would open Friday up and make it a test session, and definitely use that opportunity to introduce men and women and you know, young drivers who want to progress to Formula One. That would be their opportunity to do some really valuable testing. The costs wouldn't be that much higher because the team is already there. I think for the fans who buy a ticket for a Friday, it would give them a lot more running. And it could be a way for teams like McLaren and Williams to, you know, to make some better understanding of why their car is not competitive and to develop it. So I don't think we need to have weeks and weeks of testing and cost millions of dollars to do additional testing. I just think we need to change the format of what we do already.
Karen Chantok from Channel 4 said, whenever the Friday's practices do not happen, we see better races on Sunday, which is also beneficial to your point that we can scrap the Friday.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, the reality is, again, if the engineers, if the technicians don't get all the data from a Friday, they cannot make the racing as predictable. So they don't have enough data to base their strategy on, and you end up with a better race on Sunday. So, you know, this is again part of why I say in the digital data-driven environment that Formula One has become, One way to make it more unpredictable is to reduce the amount of data that is shared, and to put more pressure on everyone. So, yeah, good point.
What's your opinion on Mick Schumacher? When will we see him in Formula One?
I hope we see Mick Schumacher in Formula One in...
We said in 2021, because he will have 2 years in Formula Two, and then with the new rules, he can make his debut in 2021.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect time. I think it would be ideal for him to join with the new regulations. I think in terms of his age, you know, he's 19 now, so another 2 years he'll be 21. It'd be the right time for him to come in. He's done an amazing job this year. He had a tough first half of the season, and then he's had a great second half of the season. I think he won 8 races. He has had 14 podiums and win the European Formula 3 Championship. So, I mean, it's great to see. And, you know, from my point of view, having worked with Michael on his debut in Formula 1 with Jordan in 1991, then watched him develop his career, win 7 world championships, 91 races, and talked to him a few times. I'm not a friend of Michael Schumacher, so I'm not going to pretend that, but I mean, I've had some good conversations with him over the years in the paddock. You know, he stopped and talked about a couple of things, and I mean, for me, in my life, in working in Formula One, it has been an unbelievable tragedy to watch what has happened to Michael Schumacher and his family. And I think about it every day, what happened to Michael. And, you know, we don't know his condition, but I really, really hope that for him and for Corinna and the family that, you know, there's some quality of life there, because it's just such a tragedy. And then on a positive side, to see the result of Mick this year, and what a fine young guy, you know, just such a super, super young guy. He's got so much support in the sport, from fans, from media, from the teams. I really want to see him in Formula One. I hope he has a really long, happy, successful career in front of him. And I hope that he brings a lot of joy and happiness to his parents over the next years, because it will be fantastic to see him bring the Schumacher name back to the front in Formula One.
Wow, Mark, we covered a lot of ground. I took up very, very much of your time. I thank you very much for you taking the time for us today. If people want to hear from you, read from you, see you, where can they do that?
Yeah, they can do that in a number of ways. I'm on Twitter, so @_ Mark Gallagher. Just look up Mark Gallagher on Twitter. You'll find me. I'm on Instagram. I use Twitter for making comments about what's happening in Formula One. I use Instagram for posting sort of stuff about my professional world that I work in these days. Of course, look out for, there'll be another Unibet podcast with Mika Häkkinen very soon, which will be coming through. And anyone who's on LinkedIn, if you happen to use LinkedIn for business or professional reasons, I'm on LinkedIn. And I always love answering fans' questions. I'm, you know, passionate about the sport, and there's nothing better than to talk to other people about this great sport that we love and we enjoy.
Thank you very much, Mark. Stay safe, stay healthy. And
thank you.
We will make a quick break, and then we are back with Starting Grid, the Formula One magazine on meinsportradio.de.
Mein Lieblingspodcast auf meinsportradio.de.
Hallo, hier ist Felix von Total Beklubbt. Jede Woche sprechen wir über alles rund um den ersten FC Nürnberg. Spiele, Skandale und alles, was es sonst noch so gibt. Wenn euch gefällt, was ihr hört, dann lasst eine kurze Rezension bei iTunes da und gebt uns 5 Sterne.
Dir gefällt, was du hörst? Dann rezensiere unsere Sendungen jetzt auf iTunes und gib ihnen 5 Sterne. Hören, was andere denken. meinsportradio.de. Mein Lieblingspodcast auf meinsportradio.de.
Hallo, hier ist Christian Oehmicke von Double Trouble, dem Darts-Talk auf meinsportradio.de. Bei uns hörst du regelmäßig alles Wichtige zum Sport mit den Pfeilen. Wenn dir gefällt, was du hörst, schreibe gerne eine Rezension auf iTunes und bewerte unseren Podcast mit 5 Sternen.
Dir gefällt, was du hörst? Dann rezensiere unsere Sendungen jetzt auf iTunes und gib ihnen 5 Sterne.
Auf Pascale, aufpassen, nicht auf die Schulter gehen, in die Brücke, ja, er hält es. Das darf doch nicht wahr sein.
Ringen auf meinsportradio.de. In Zusammenarbeit mit dem Deutschen Ringerbund berichtet meinsportradio.de exklusiv über den deutschen Ringersport. Jede Woche neu, auch als Podcast mit Malte Asmus. Ringen auf meinsportradio.de.
Nochmal kurz zurück hier bei Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Magazin auf meinsportradio.de. Ja, ich hoffe, es hat euch gefallen. Mehr kann ich einfach nicht sagen. Es macht mir unglaublich viel Freude, wie wir auch diesen Podcast so aufgebaut haben, dass wir diese Gäste bekommen, wie David Coulthard, wie Nico Hülkenberg letzte Saison, wie auch natürlich Mark Gallagher. Vielen Dank nochmal, Mark. Und vielen Dank euch fürs Zuhören heute. Ich hoffe, es hat euch Spaß gemacht. Wir werden dranbleiben, weiter solche tollen Interviews zu bekommen. Mir macht es sehr viel Spaß, mit diesen Personen zu sprechen und ja auch deren Wissen aufzusaugen und deren Geschichten zu hören. Wir sind dabei, Gerhard Berger in die Sendung zu bekommen. Da hoffen wir drauf, dass das nach der Saison der Fall sein wird, dass wir dann auch ein Interview mit Gerhard Berger führen können. Einstweilen bedanke ich mich bei euch fürs Zuhören. Ich bedanke mich bei euch für die Treue, die ihr Starting Grid zeigt. Das ist nicht selbstverständlich. Ihr seid mit Teil dessen, dass das hier wachsen kann, dass wir immer weiter nach vorne kommen können mit diesem Podcast. Und deswegen empfehlt uns, sagt es euren Freunden, Bekannten, Verwandten, dass es diesen Formel 1 Podcast gibt. Rezensiert ihn gerne bei iTunes mit 5 Sternen. Folgt mir bei Twitter, wenn ihr wollt, @ks_0811, benutzt den Hashtag StartingGridMSR, benutzt den Hashtag RoosSura vor F1TV, wenn ihr auch wollt, dass Marc Surer und Sascha Roos nächstes Jahr die deutschen Kommentatoren bei F1TV sind. Wir haben gemerkt, man sieht diesen Hashtag, ja, bei dem F1 Help Channel, die sich auch um F1TV kümmern, sieht man ihn und ihr könnt mit dafür sorgen vielleicht, dass Marc Surer und Sascha Roos nächstes Jahr kommentieren dürfen für uns, denn wir sind es leid, dass wir nur den RTL-Kommentar bekommen. Es ist nur eine Seite des Ganzen, wie Mark Gallagher auch richtig sagt. Wir wollen beide Seiten. Wir wollen für alle einen exklusiven Kommentar, egal ob für Englisch, für Französisch, Spanisch, Deutsch. Wenn man diesen Service bezahlt, dann soll man auch einen extra Kommentar bekommen. Deswegen Hashtag RoosSura vor F1TV. Wenn ihr das auch wollt, teilt es. Ja, vielleicht kriegen wir es hin, vielleicht auch nicht. Wir haben es dann aber zumindest versucht. Wie gesagt, morgen geht es dann schon weiter mit der regulären Ausgabe von Starting Grid, dann mit Ole Waschkau und Christian Nimmervoll von motorsporttotal.com, formel1.de und de.motorsport.com. Mein Name ist Kevin Scheuren, ich bin raus und bis morgen gilt wie immer nur eins, keep racing.
Mein Lieblingspodcast auf meinsportradio.de.
Kevin Scheuren hier von Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Magazin auf meinsportradio.de. Zu jedem Rennwochenende bringen wir dir alles, was du brauchst, um bei der Königsklasse des Motorsports up-to-date zu sein. Vorberichte, Nachberichte, Analysen und Meinungen, das alles gibt's hier. Und wenn dir gefällt, was du hörst, dann bring Starting Grid bei iTunes auf die Pole Position. Wie das geht? Eine kleine Rezension schreiben und 5 Sterne dalassen und schon sind wir auf dem Treppchen ganz oben.
Dir gefällt, was du hörst? Dann rezensiere unsere Sendungen jetzt auf iTunes und gib ihnen 5 Sterne. Die Formel 1 auf meinsportradio.de wird dir präsentiert von motorsporttotal.com und formel1.de.
Der Toyota CHR. Kompakt SUV. Ein Statement. Genau wie sein Preis. Jetzt ab 19.990 Euro. Fragen Sie nach individuellen Preisen.
Bei 3H Automobile in Köln.
Nichts ist unmöglich. Toyota.